Welcome to Power Station. Today we are joined by two attorneys from the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. They've come in today from Baltimore to Podcast Village in Washington, D.C. It's only 105 heat index, so I particularly am grateful for their appearance. And joining us to talk about the work of the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau, and particularly their initiative, which is the Community Lawyering Initiative. It's really important and exciting and something new. So I'm interested in learning more about it, and I think you all will be also. I'm happy to introduce to you first Megan McDermott and Amy Petkosic, and to thank them for being here. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having us today.
Amy, can you start by telling us about the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau? I think some of our listeners know legal aid and legal services. We don't always know the many forms that it comes in. One thing that strikes me about Maryland Legal Aid is how robust of a system it is and how dynamically you support people in gaining access to their rights, whether it's veterans benefits, protection against eviction, and other areas of civil law. Can you tell us more about the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau overall?
Maryland Legal Aid is a statewide organization. We have 12 offices throughout the state that serve every county in the state of Maryland, and we are civil legal services.
Yes.
And what that means is lawyers for poor people in everything that's not criminal or immigration related. So as you said, we handle divorce, custody, domestic violence, bankruptcies, home foreclosures. We help homeless veterans who are on the streets. We have an elder abuse program. We have this community lawyering initiative to help people with criminal record expungements and beyond. What we're really trying to do is look at people's human rights and look at the civil legal system and how can we pair people with lawyers to access their rights.
It seems so simple in one way and also complicated in another. People have rights that they need to be connected to and to have enforced, but therein lies the tale. First, you have to let people know that you are there. They have to find you, and you have to connect with them in a way that they can be successful in addressing their challenges. What are some of the main obstacles or barriers to access?
Our clients face so many barriers every day, mostly because they're poor and because of racial discrimination, because of systems of inequality that have gone on for years and years and years. It's hard for them to access transportation, to get to medical appointments, to get to appointments for their children, to get to a job. Daycare is an expense that is out of this world. How they can put money on a phone so they can call the services and obtain the services they need to. How they can go to work and then still spend a whole day waiting in line at three different government agencies to try and turn in the paperwork they need to. So the barriers that our clients face are vast, and they need to figure out how to fit legal services into that. So the more that we can do at Maryland Legal Aid to make our services accessible to clients, we try to do that in innovative ways every day.
And Megan, in terms of those innovations, how do you sort of sort out when somebody comes to you, either are they walking in a door, are they calling you, how are they accessing you, and how are they able to then present to you, here's the problem that I need you to help me solve? Because I would imagine that all of our households, we might have more than one challenge that we're dealing with. So it may be lack of employment has led to a problem with our housing affordability, and the housing code conditions factor into that. Also benefits for veterans that they might be entitled to and not getting. There's a lot to sort through there. Is there a process that you've developed that helps you to do that more successfully?
Legal Aid has a couple of different intake options. We do have walk-in intake at all of our offices. For example, in Baltimore City, where Amy and I have offices, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, people can come in from 8:30 to 1 o'clock and just walk in, tell the front desk what their problem is, and then go from there. We also have telephone intake and online intake. So that helps people who might not be able to leave their home because they have a disability. They can go to a library and use a library to do an online intake. We also have specific lines for veterans. So attorneys who understand specific needs of military veterans are going to be staffing those lines. Then we have community lawyering, and we're actually embedding that intake process in the community. So we're in libraries, we're in rehabilitation centers. Just this morning, our team was in a drug treatment center in West Baltimore. And we were just doing expungements today, but often we have attorneys from all of our substantive areas of law. And you're right, our clients often have sort of these complex legal issues. They might have an old criminal charge that caused them to lose housing, and then maybe they lost employment. So sometimes they're coming in for expungement, but then we're also helping them address being denied unemployment.
Yes.
And helping them figure out how to access public housing. So there are a lot of layers to our clients' legal needs.
Did the data show you that expungement is a critical barrier? Can you say a little bit more about that and about what expungement is?
So expungement is cleaning up someone's criminal record. Sometimes we're not able to remove everything from someone's criminal record, and every state has sort of its own laws regarding expungement.
Yeah.
So we're able to expunge records from criminal cases in the state of Maryland. And things that don't result in a conviction can almost always be expunged. So dismissals, acquittals, things like that, and probation before judgment. And they all sort of have different timelines when they can come off. And in Maryland, we've sort of moved in a more progressive way towards expunging more items from records. So now there are certain classes of misdemeanor convictions that can come off of records. And starting in October, there'll be 3 felonies that can come off of records. Now, for these convictions, sometimes people are like, oh, yikes, bad guys are getting away with something. That's really not true. That's a multi-layered problem maybe we can talk about. But also, to get a conviction off, you have to meet certain requirements. And other than marijuana convictions, you have to wait at least 10 years to get a conviction off your record. And you can't have any subsequent convictions. So it's really a second chance for someone who made that one, you know, big mistake in their youth, and they've changed their life. And they've shown that by not getting in trouble again for a decade. And some require 15 years. The felonies will require 15 years.
That's an opportunity that might be afforded more middle class people differently, but that struggle for poor people and people of color to overcome that hurdle is really tremendous. So by the time they get to you, they've already spent a lot of time with that conviction, with that hold, and now you are helping to free them from it, which gives them access to employment, to housing, to being able to be more engaged members of the community. It seems hard to argue against that. Is there an argument against it? Do you get pushback? And is there a concern that has been expressed to you to not go forward with this type of program?
By and large, once we show the results and that individuals are getting jobs, everyone's in favor of individuals having employment and being able to move forward. We have individuals who may be curious about what we do and want to come for one time to volunteer. We take attorney volunteers and non-attorney volunteers. So they come to a clinic, and at most of our expungement clinics, individual clients will come up and give you a hug if they've never met you. They're so grateful. A mother will look at you with tears in her eyes and not believe that you can really take everything off her record that she's been carrying around. We have people who look at us and say, you know, I feel 30 pounds lighter walking out of here today.
And so when you see
that over and over, it's generally the response is very favorable from everyone who's watching it.
That's amazing. How does this strategy for expungement assistance build that kind of partnership? Now, I'm saying that knowing that Wilhelm Joseph, who runs the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau, is a consummate collaborator and connector of people. I've seen him do it for many years. He does, in fact, build relationships and really articulate the issues and the type of resources that you bring in a way that is tremendously positive. Is that what it takes to get that work done? I would imagine it takes a lot of collaboration and partners that are up for this kind of effort.
I would turn that around just a little and say even more partners that are up for it. It would be that the legal aid or the nonprofit would have to be up for listening to the partner and listening to the community that you're in, because our partners in East Baltimore, West Baltimore, Hagerstown, rural Maryland, and down on the shore are all very different.
Yes.
And so what we have learned in the past 3 years is that it's very important to build community trust. You know, we're in workforce development centers with these expungements. So we're right in where people are looking for jobs, and churches and places of worship and libraries. But the feel in every community is very different. They have clients that come in for different reasons at different times of day. Some communities have all family law, divorce, domestic violence issues, others where it's all expungement. So the flavor of a community, it really depends on their needs and should be driven by the community and by the people who have a voice in what happens there. So it's very important for our program to be flexible and to build those partnerships one step at a time and not to barge in and say, we do this one way everywhere.
You're absolutely right. I mean, those settings are so different geographically, demographically, it would not be doable without having a sensitivity to who's there and what their interests and needs are. Can you tell me a story of somebody that you have seen through a process with expungement that has really created a difference in their life?
There are so many stories. Okay. We have a client who's gone on shows before and loves to talk about her experience. She visited us at our original library branch, the neighborhood where Freddie Gray came from in Baltimore City at the Pennsylvania Avenue Library. She got over 30 items expunged off of her record. She had served time in prison for over 10 years, and she really couldn't believe when she watched them come in the mail one at a time when they were granted. She got a new order for each one that was granted, and she felt more and more empowered. And now she has started her own nonprofit organization. She works with homeless shelters in Baltimore City, and she's now speaking to other groups of women, trying to let them know about the process and let them know that there can be a second chance on life and a new attitude. She speaks not only about the fact that her record was cleared, but that she felt empowered, respected through the process, and the fear of being judged over her record is what stopped her from coming in for years and years to meet with an attorney or anyone who might help.
That must be such a powerful moment for you. It's a community problem and a societal challenge, but it's also a personal experience. And to build the kind of trust and collaboration that you would need with a community member to help them through this process must be an amazing experience, but also in the context of West Baltimore and all of the travesties of justice and the challenges that remain there. What has been your experience there? How have you helped to articulate to the people that you're working with that you are helping them and that they can trust in you and this institution that they may not know that well, that is the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau?
It is tricky because I think just walking in often as a middle-class white woman, I haven't had the same life experiences as most of my clients. Mm-hmm. And we both understand that. Mm-hmm. My clients are just as intelligent as I am. They know that. And being empathetic, being kind is really important, sort of explaining why you're there and saying, I'm not here to judge you, because some clients do get really quiet as you're looking through their record or jotting down information about their children. Often, you're the first person in the system who is really listening to them and is trying to be an advocate and a partner and trying to move their life forward. And their experiences before they saw me might have been with DSS, might have been with the court system or the jail or a police officer, and they were probably negative. So it's just important to be kind, to be flexible and have a good sense of humor, and just to talk about the realities of the situation. So a lot of our clients will have seriously 30 charges for open container or riding a bike without a headlight. I do those things too. And I have joked with clients that I'll likely never get pulled over by a police officer for riding my bike without a headlight because I'm riding my bike without a headlight in the wealthier area of Baltimore. And just sort of important to go in with that perspective. And when we do have volunteers come in, it's really important, if you've never worked with low-income people, that people are people everywhere. Amy's right that the poverty can look different in rural communities versus urban communities, but all people want the same things. They want their kids to be safe, and they want to feel safe in their community and feel seen.
Yes, and I think the fact that you are an institution, I mean, you may not feel institutional, I don't know, but I would imagine from their perception, that's the first way that they're looking at you. And then that this institution, for once, is working for them and with them must be very profound for their experience.
It's actually part of the mission and goals behind the Community Lawyering Initiative is that we are in places that clients already trust. So instead of going into a government building or a legal aid office or taking three buses to get downtown, we are in their libraries where they already go as a safe haven. We're in their community centers, their church, their drug treatment center, the domestic violence shelter. So we are already taking that barrier down. And then when we're in there, our first job is to listen to what their needs are and then to serve from there. There have been new projects that have come out of this initiative that we didn't go in intending to do, but we listened to client needs and have started new legal initiatives because of that.
How is your organization building community influence and power? Some organizations do it in a very explicit way, some in a more subtle way, but really all of them at some level are engaging people. So I'm wondering if that fits into the scenario that Amy just referenced, and can you tell us more about that?
One of my pet projects in the past year has been civil forfeiture. For listeners who might not know, that's when someone is arrested and their property is taken and put in evidence by the police. And there's been a lot going on with the Baltimore Police Department in the past couple of years. The civil forfeiture has come to the forefront, and Amy and I and our other attorneys have had clients that have come to get expungements done and will say, oh, well, this was nulprost. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, when this happened, a police officer took my money and the case was dismissed. And there's different rules about when you can get your money back and things like that. But when you're not found guilty, you should always get it back and there should always be a record of it. And there's some challenges that there often isn't a record of the money at all. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. So we have started a pilot program with the public defenders, which is really neat because we have a lot of overlapping clients, or we're serving a lot of the same neighborhoods, right, at the very least. Right. So we started a program where they refer their clients whose cases have been dismissed and where they know that there's been money seized by the police to us, so we can start the process of getting the money back for them. And the important thing for that is for our low-income clients, if you lose $500, that's everything.
Yes.
That's paying for all of your groceries that month and your rent. $500 for me would be a big deal. But for our clients, it's really can be a life or death kind of thing, mm-hmm, that can keep them from slipping back into whatever was going on before they were arrested. That's a brand new project, but we're really excited about it. And I think trying to build these partnerships among other legal providers is really important too, because, you know, we don't know what they're doing over there. They don't know what we're doing. And there's this great way to collaborate and maybe eventually have other links from the public defenders to other sort of civil areas of law as well.
And that's exciting. I guess I would think of that as a subtle but very impactful way to address an ongoing huge issue, which has gotten more attention recently, but which is not new. What are other areas that you address in the Community Lawyering Initiative? And you talked, Amy, about listening and understanding sort of in each of these offices and geographic areas, what are the issues, the sensitivities, the concerns? What do you bring back to the Legal Aid Bureau that informs your work going forward?
When we go out to from Baltimore City up to the mountains, down to the shore, mm-hmm, we partner with our local legal aid offices and local private attorney partners.
Yes.
And so it's never just the Community Lawyering Initiative team, which is a staff team of about 13 people who work full time with the community lawyering, but it's also the chief attorney who's involved in the staff attorneys and paralegals in those local offices who work in those regions all the time.
Yes.
And so they may have worked in Frederick County or in Cumberland for their entire career, but may have never been out to some of these libraries or churches in the same way, or job development centers. And so our unit is able to empower them to have better insight into the community that they serve, and repositioning yourself. It's really about lawyer as place and making that place closer to the clients in a lot of different ways. And that really helps us inform where we're going as an organization, where we're going in each region, and where we need the private bar to assist us.
We talk a lot when we have community development organizations here about placemaking and community development, but it's so tied into what you're talking about. It's placemaking also, and your partners being experts in their place and having those community-based connections enables you to be more effective also. It really is an interesting collaborative model that you have. It seems as though that is central to the success of the Legal Aid Bureau overall, in that some legal aid and legal services offices are not as flourishing as yours might be in this time. There's both the federal context of this is a program that requires federal funding and has been embattled over periods of time, but it's also the benefit of collaboration to this work is essential. And it looks, when I look at your website, you have a lot of partners, both law firms and, as you were talking about, infrastructure within the state. Can you say more about those collaborations and their kind of richness and ingenuity?
Often in the nonprofit world and in the legal world, we operate in silos. We have those nonprofits who help in the education spectrum. We have those who help like legal aid in the legal spectrum, and we could go on and on and on. In the legal world, we have nonprofit attorneys, and then we have private firms. Then we have solo practitioners. So really what this is about is breaking down those silos,
yeah,
and saying,
uh-huh,
informing each other about what we do and the great parts about each of those groups I just mentioned and what they can give to each other. So nonprofit-wise, how can we connect with groups that are already inside schools or inside job development centers, helping people with resume building and interview skills? And those are great things. And how about if I expunge their record too? Mm-hmm. And we do it all together at the same time.
Yes.
And on the legal side, law firms have tremendous resources, both in terms of talent and in terms of financial resources. Solo practitioners have great client skills. They've had to build their own client base for years. So what if we take those other silos of the legal world and build them into our program? And how stronger can we be, both financially and in terms of a volunteerism perspective? And when you put your time and your talent and your resources all together, how much more strongly can you affect that gap in justice that so many of our clients are facing every day? And that's really what this program and what Legal Aid in Maryland has been about for the last few decades. But as we look into the future, really the way we see our work going is this idea of collaboration, partnerships, and coming together for this common cause and building on our own skills and talents.
What do you think that your partners are learning? It seems as though you are sort of an educator and supporter of the community, but also of these partners that you're dealing with. Do you see more of an appetite and an excitement by the private firms to work with you?
We absolutely do. The excitement really builds. In terms of community partners, people do not realize what Civil Legal Services is. We might come out for an expungement and then they don't realize we can help with their eviction or their rent escrow action or their domestic violence situation. Megan started a partnership with a group called the Men and Family Center in East Baltimore, and it's been going on for a few years now. We now have a lawyer that goes there once a week, and we have occasional Saturday all-day events, and they just named it their Summer Grand Slam event, and they were so excited to have Legal Aid as a part of it. Like, the excitement is contagious. And from the law firms, they're adopting days, and they reach out to us and say, we'd like to take a Friday and have a casual Friday and come to the local homeless shelter and do a clinic with you. And they're reaching out to us to adopt days at libraries where it can be that law firm's day at the library. The excitement, it is really contagious. It's really great to be able to give individuals that opportunity to serve and to see what Civil Legal Services is all about. And in the end, it really helps the clients, and that's what we're here for.
How do you feel that the people you're serving are connecting to the bigger picture? Do you feel that they are seeing, I'm getting this tremendous help, getting this expungement done, which leaves me open to the possibility of employment and housing and benefits? Are you able to make that connection for people? Are they making it themselves? This is a community-wide problem. I can be part of a solution. I might be able to go and tell people in my church or my children's school about these resources and get them more engaged.
Our clients recognize it on their own. I think often clients do come to clinics, and sometimes when we're doing expungements, it takes 30 minutes with one client or longer, and we're just sort of chatting, and they might mention they have this other issue, so we can kind of point them to another attorney in that room they can go talk to. I will say a lot of our programs have really grown by word of mouth. So when Amy and Gusty at Maryland Legal Aid started community lawyering in 2015, I think the first time or two they went, there was a few handfuls of people at the first library, and then it blew up. 3 or 4 weeks later, I think there were 500 people in line. And a lot of our libraries will start out kind of slow. There'll be 5 or 10 people, and then there'll be 20 people. And every week at Pennsylvania Avenue, which is our first site, we still have 40 people often every single Tuesday. So it's definitely word of mouth in the community, and it's that sense of trust that they're there every week or every month or every quarter, depending on which location. And some of our community partners we've found through our clients, they'll say, there's this other library down the road, and we go there instead. Would you ever come there? Or the treatment center that we went to this morning that I mentioned earlier, they were bringing their clients to one of our libraries. And finally, they said, well, why don't you guys come to us? There's so many of us that need this service, come to us instead. It's really coming from both sides of the spectrum. And as far as building with partners, I came into the project about a year and a half ago, and I was lucky because a lot of the work was already done for me. And we have so many partners always reaching out. And I don't know if that's how it was in the beginning or not, but now I would say we have 2 or 3 calls a week from people all over the state and Baltimore City asking, when can you come here? How do we get you here? How does it work? So there's certainly lots of that.
You also have some great nonprofits in your state, Casa for All, Casa de Maryland, Latino Economic Development Center. So I'm sure that these groups come to you also to address the legal area of the social and economic side of what they're addressing in the community. So that would be another level of a partnership, I assume, that you're working on also.
We often have advocacy groups that will come to us to ask us about the impact of different policies on our clients. Mm-hmm. And so when we are asked that question, we are able to let people know what we see in our clients' lives every day. And so we can connect those clients with those advocacy organizations
Yes. So
they can carry on that cause in Yeah. Their policymaking.
It's so important because there's many sides to these issues. There's immediate help, which is needed, which is not so immediate because people have been sitting with these problems for decades. And as you say, there's the service, the program, the advocacy, sometimes the other types of engagement. So you're playing a pivotal role, and that collaboration is what's going to make it much richer. You have 13 people on staff.
That's right. Plus a number of summer law clerks and volunteers.
Okay.
And then we have over 100 volunteers that are law students, paralegals, and attorney volunteers across the state.
That's amazing. So that's already a lot in a short amount of time that you've helped to build out. Do you see this program growing or sustaining itself over time?
We absolutely see the growth. There should be a lawyer in every library, in every job treatment center across Maryland, in drug treatment centers there should be, in community centers, recreation centers, homeless shelters. And this is where clients are who need help. We hope to have a team in every region. We will continue to seek resources. We're always looking for new, innovative ways to serve clients and to also find resources to serve those clients. And we will continue to do so. The work speaks for itself.
Yes.
And the clients also speak for the work. The more we can continue the work and get the word out there about what amazing things this is doing and what Lawyer as Place really means, I think that we can continue to grow this program. It's only been less than 3 years, and we hope to take it far.
And I think it's interesting, too, we had a conversation with some of our supervisors in our intake unit in Baltimore City. Even though we've been exploding, as Amy said, and we're really expanding into all these communities, our intake numbers as walk-ins have not dropped. That says to us that these are communities that sometimes are only 3 miles away that just don't come into the center city,
Yes. Downtown
Baltimore,
Yes. Or
don't make it into our Frederick downtown office. So it's really, really important to realize that sometimes these communities in other urban areas within our city, they're still really, really isolated. So it's so important for us to be able to expand into the rural areas, into other parts of the cities.
It's obvious, but it strikes me as radical in a way that you are flexible enough that you are going to where people are rather than asking them to conform to the old model of just coming to you. And clearly in an area that has been so profoundly underserved, that is a very important ingredient to your success. So you're keeping your eyes open for what those areas are and having people tell you where you need to be is a really important piece of information and a call to action for the initiative.
Absolutely. I mean, we're walking into these communities not just to say, let's write your name down on a list. We're
Yes. Coming
in to give your listeners an image with a red wagon filled with laptops
Yes. And
printers. And we set up a mobile legal office and provide on-site immediate assistance to the clients right there. And we hope to continue to do that.
I think for the libraries, for the people you're serving within them, for the policymakers in municipalities and statewide and even nationally, this is such a demonstration of what can be done and what ultimately is really good for communities. As you've said, having people working, having them in decent housing, that's what we need for a better society. So thank you so much, Megan and Amy, for talking to me today and to Power Station and for telling the story. We could go on for longer, but I can't hold you. I have a feeling you're going off somewhere with the red wagon. But I'd like you to tell our listeners where they can find out more information, because some of them might want to volunteer, they might want to donate, they might want to be engaged in one of those 12 offices or in all of the places that you go.
Thank you. The best place to go is to our website. It's www.mdlab.org, for Maryland Legal Aid Bureau.org. And the front page of the website, if there's any clients listening, tells where our clinics are, date, time, and place. And then on that webpage, there's also a volunteer link. If you click on the link and connect your information, we'll be connected to you.
Fantastic. It's exciting. Thank you so much for joining us today and for this great initiative. Thanks all for listening to Power Station. It was great to have on Amy Petkosic and Megan McDermott from the Maryland Legal Aid Bureau and the Community Lawyering Initiative. They talked at the end of their talk about that little red wagon. Go look for it on their site, mdlab.org, and find out how you might get more involved. This is Ann Pasmanick. Thanks so much for listening to Power Station. Talk to you again soon.